Thank you for joining us today. I'm Johnny Emson alongside Melissa from Cutting Through the Matrix. Melissa, how are you?
I am post-nasal.
You're recovering. It's been a few days since you've been on. Is there anything that's been front and center? Have you paid attention to the news at all or anything of the events of the day since you've been down? I know you were down sick for a couple of days. The day after we, or no, 2 days after we recorded, you went down for the count.
I actually went down that night, Friday night. I was down for the count all day long on Saturday and managed to drag myself out of bed on Sunday and make a little redux and then go right back down to bed, just like, blah, crash. And yesterday I recorded a real history. So I'm mostly, for the most part, up and at it again. Not 100%.
Yeah, well, that's good.
So to answer your question, no, I haven't followed the news.
Yeah, well, there's not a whole lot that I have to speak of, really. But there's an overthrow that's currently happening right now, it looks like, in Nairobi. In Kenya. I know that we've talked a lot about different things that are going on in the continent of Africa, South Africa mostly, some of the things that have been going on down there. But yeah, I don't know if you want to call it a coup, but people have stormed the parliament building. There was a tax hike that was proposed or something. To the best of my knowledge, I don't know. Our media is not covering it, and it's pretty bad. Some of the things that are going on down there. I'll just run some footage of what's happening at the moment. It's like, this is inside their main parliament building where this is going on, and nothing is being talked about in our media anywhere. So it's just, and they set fire to it, and it's a thing.
Well, I'll have to immediately Skype on this one because I've done a real history with an interesting gentleman who's from Somalia, and his father was a career diplomat. They ended up in England because of what was going on in Somalia then at that time. This is back in the 1980s, I guess, or late 70s, 80s. And he's just spent a whole bunch of time in Kenya. Now, as far as I know, he's been out of there for the last couple of months, but I'll have to check in with him because he lived in Kenya for a while as a child and he's enjoyed being back there. So if anybody is going to have an insider's kind of idea of what's really happening, it will be him. And that his name is Osman. I've done two real histories with him. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll check with him.
Yeah, this is like the big thing that's going on today. But again, this is not in our media at all. None of this has been.
No, covered. Terrible.
Yeah. So there is that that's going on, and I've been kind of following that and everything that's happening. Now there is something else. This goes back to this is like the climate change thing. I mean, we can kind of maybe roll into this, but they're saying now there's going to be droughts that are going to now hit us. Now, this has been one of the rainiest summers that I've seen in quite some time. So I don't foresee a drought happening. But have you ever heard the theory? And this is another, this kind of goes back to the thing that we talked about in the soundcheck. This also involves one of the individuals that we were discussing in the soundcheck, the same one that was talking about hydroglyphics. Are you aware of the theory that the rivers are not actually based on Earth? They're actually in the clouds. I know. I heard this once and I thought that is not real. That's crazy. And they're all computer controlled too. I might like to throw that in there, according to this individual.
Okay. This is a new one on me. I really,
But all the droughts, we're talking about crazy conspiracies. I tell you what we need to do. I ran this past Bruce once. We were going to do a conspiracy corner podcast, and it was just going to be like the craziest conspiracy theories out there. And we were just going to go through and we were going to try and debunk all of them. And this is one of them that I wanted to do, was to do this rivers in the sky kind of thing. So I know it's crazy. So it's computer controlled. All the rivers are computer controlled, and someone sits somewhere, I don't know where, according to this individual, and they control how much water is in the rivers, and they can turn it off when they want, and they can make floods. I'm not joking. They can make floods happen when they want.
Because of the computer controlled rivers in the sky.
Yes. And all the rivers flow in the clouds. Yes. I'm not joking. That's actually something that this individual has mentioned before. I couldn't follow it. I turned the podcast off after I heard that because I thought
Is this the person whose name makes you think of an egg?
Yes, that's the one.
Oh, Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, I was, yeah. You just when you think you've heard it all, here's the trouble with something like that. I mean, if you and Bruce did it, I'm sure that it would be entertaining. I wouldn't want to do something like that because there are so many people who would let me know immediately, and you will experience this, just heads up, a word to the wise. They'll come out of the woodwork and tell you why it's true and why you're wrong.
Oh, yes.
And why, yeah, yeah, and you'll just be bombarded with any, because I've heard a lot of really crazy whack conspiracies.
Yeah, you get just like we do, you get hate mail all the time, don't you? No, we get hate mail.
I get plenty.
Yeah. Well, Marty actually said if we don't get at least 3 death threats per week, we're not doing a good enough job. So we get hate mail quite a bit. So it doesn't matter, I think, really, your viewpoint on anything. So if someone...
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, if someone says, okay, well, here, you're wrong, and this is why, and then they'll send you 1,500 Wikipedia links as to why you're wrong, which is, you know, that's a... apparently, that's a great source. That actually is in the news, Wikipedia. Did you hear about what's going on with Wikipedia?
No.
They've changed some things around. Wikipedia says that they're going to switch to AI as part of their thing. So Wikipedia right now is it 900 people or something like that? 9 to 1200 people that edit Wikipedia?
In Israel.
Is it? I don't know. I don't know if that's what it is. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. It's basically...
Is it an Israeli news site? I didn't know that.
Or less.
Encyclopedia, I mean, thing.
Well, not on the surface, but, you know, this has been... I mean, I'm not saying that sarcastically. There is a unofficial, strong Israeli component to the people who actually input the entries.
Okay. That's interesting. And now they're talking about switching to AI. What do you think about AI being used to, I guess, report the news, if you will? Because right now we've got so-called journalists that actually put together these things. Well, they're saying if with the introduction of AI, you're actually going to make journalists obsolete. So the AI will actually be able to write the articles now. So what does that mean for social engineering?
Well, I think in reality, we have been at computer-generated news for a long time now. So whether, I'm not sure that you could say that it's AI-generated, but this is, it's Orwellian. It's 1984. It's just something that's being cranked out. And when you read the quality of news in most publications, and I'm including the big prestigious ones like the Washington Post and the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the biggies, there is something very manufactured about it. It has a very manufactured quality. And I was, I had the opportunity, one of my brothers goes to these little town luncheons that kind of keep him abreast of what's going on in the area. And every once in a while, if I have time, I go with him. And about 6 or 7 months ago, I went to one of these luncheons, and there was a reporter, a real genuine reporter man that had been covering news in the area. I think his paper was the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, which is a local big city newspaper. And he'd been working there for 30 or 40 years. And he said, you know, somebody in the audience said, when will computer, you know, AI generated news take over what we're reading on a day-to-day basis? And he said, look, this has been going on for 2 decades in some fashion or other. And all AI is doing is a bigger percentage of it, more seamless, maybe a slightly better quality to it. But he said most of what you read in your local newspaper has been more or less, and I think the percentage he said was about 60% of it is basically in some fashion or another just generated, you know. And I don't know how that works. He wasn't there to answer specifics of it, but you know, that's what he said.
That's interesting. Generated. I don't know how would you do that? I know how AI would probably do it using their algorithms to generate something, but the fact that it's been going on for 2 decades, that's
well, what he talked about is slightly, I mean, I think it's more like if you think about IBM punch cards you know, keep and how those have been on the go for 100 years and the kind of data that was available and the that punch card system was able to collate an incredible amount of documentation about who you were, where you lived, who you associated with. And now that has become computerized in a different way, and it's just much more efficient. It's in real time. So when you're looking at your phone, if you're looking at your phone and you say, I want to see such and such, then, you know, almost instantly you're going to get an ad or something else that's going to come up that's thematically in the same vein as what you were just looking at. So what this reporter was talking about was more like an IBM punch card kind of technology, I think. What he was saying is you've got centralized public relations outlets. You might have two or three main news bodies that just correlate press releases from companies, press releases from governments. It's just PR, PR, PR.
Yeah, it's all the same talking points.
And then this is literally just fed into a computer, which spits it out into something that looks like it was an article.
You said that, and I don't want to miss the term that you used there. You said you feel as though it's almost been manufactured for a very long time. Well, that is true. In a real sense, it is, because the people that write, quote, write for these papers, the journalists that write for the papers, all come from manufactured institutions, all the same journalist schools. They all come from the same place. Yeah. And they're all taught the same standard. And that's actually the term that's used when you go into the journalism world, when you go to one of these prestigious places such as that, or former prestigious places. The New York Times is not exactly doing so hot. They've actually had to sell whole floors in their building because their subscription services are just, gone. But I think that's
true. And the Post has taken a hit because the Washington Post.
The LA Times as well, I might add. But a lot of the major papers are taking hits. They've been doing cutbacks for almost 20 years now, slow cutbacks. But I think that's due in part to a lot of other things with technology and the way that things have progressed. The papers, the physical paper just doesn't even, like, that's not a thing anymore. I can't tell you the last time I saw somebody with a physical paper other than like the copies that are just laying on the cafe table somewhere over here. And that's really about it. Or maybe the library or something. They'll pick up one for everybody to read. But manufactured, getting back to that point, when they go to the same institutions and they get churned out, they obviously get an internship or a job writing for a paper in one of these bigger places. They'll start out at a small one and then work their way up. But when they get to these bigger ones, like you're talking about, they get the talking points fed to them, you know, the PR things fed to them, and they're told by the editors at all times, we have a standard here, and this is the standard we follow. And if you don't write to this standard, then you're not going to be working here for very long. And that's it.
Right.
You know, the world of journalism as a contract journalist is a very cutthroat industry, just like anything else. You can go to work for a paper one day, and you can be fired the next if you write something that's not approved or that's not to that standard, if you will. And so they have to follow that standard. They'll have their usual people that they reach out to in the PR departments, in governments, you know, that senator or that congressperson or that spokesman at the State Department or whoever at the DOD or the White House or whoever. And that's it. That's why you have all those useless empty suits that are sitting in the White House press room every day, listening to that mop up there at the podium, giving the press briefing every day. And they're all asking pointless questions that don't mean anything. And it's been going on that way for a very long time. It's a stage performance, and it's all scripted. It's all manufactured, as you said.
I mean, there's a couple of things there that you said. First of all, you have like Annenberg. There is a couple. Annenberg is probably the most prestigious school of journalism, but there are a couple of others. And one, I think it's called Western Journalism. I go there every once in a while because they're ever so slightly outside the box of what you'll get with the Annenberg reporter. But these reporters know who butters their bread. They know how it's, and they know from the gate before they ever get their first job what is involved here, and that they have that, as you said, standard. And there was a movie made about the guy, he killed himself, Gary Webb. Did you ever see that?
You said it was a movie?
No, it's about a journalist, Gary Webb. So occasionally now, this guy has been vilified, especially posthumously. But even before he committed suicide, he committed suicide with two bullets, I think.
But he missed on the first one.
Yeah.
Okay, so he did an
Gary Webb.
Yeah, 2000. Yeah. I see here, died December 10th, 2004. He did an expose and an interview on the CIA and the drug cartels
right,
in 2002. Yeah. And then he committed suicide with the use of two bullets. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And evidently that, you know, if you take the official story, that's true. The first one just kind of, you know, didn't do it and he had to do it again. But I actually do believe, I really do believe that he committed suicide. And here's why. He was destroyed for writing that. That story should have catapulted him into the highest levels of journalistic excellence and recognition. But what he got was censure and criticism. And immediately, what I'm talking about is character assassination. The character assassination squad went to work on him immediately. And he was not supported by I think Sacramento Bee was it, the Sacramento Bee that published it. And they were known for being willing to publish the occasional so-called risky piece. And he got no support. And basically what I consider to be fine investigative journalism ended up just destroying his career. And there are other examples. I'm not the guy who wrote CIA in the Media back in the 70s. Let's investigate his name. And that basically, if you want to think about the CIA and the Media. Now, I'm not Carl Bernstein. OK, Woodward and Bernstein.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not going to just jump on board with Carl Bernstein and talk about what an amazing reporter he was, because I think he was fed an awful lot. And I think even his exposés and what he put out on Project Mockingbird and all that, I believe that there was an awful lot fed to him with a spin in a certain direction. But here this is his famous 1977 Rolling Stone article. It said, after leaving the Washington Post in 1977, Carl Bernstein spent 6 months looking at the relationship of the CIA and the press during the Cold War years. His 25,000-word cover story, published in Rolling Stone on October 20, 1977, is reprinted below. The CIA and the Media. How America's most powerful news media worked hand in glove with the Central Intelligence Agency, and why the Church Committee covered it up. So that is going to take you into Project Mockingbird, control of the media, CIA control of the media. And what you need to know is that if the CIA has got their, if they have control of something, they don't let control go.
No, they don't.
So
no,
you can take it to the bank that what they controlled in at the era that Bernstein is covering from the 50s on, they still have control of today. And Alan used to cite several things that were very interesting. Unfortunately, this first one, I can't remember his source on it, but this is the how many newspapers do we, the elite, need to control in order to have a uniform consensus of what we call news? And I believe that the number that they came up with, I have to source this from, you know, Alan's talks, look into it a little bit, but I think it was like 25 papers. It's not much, because if you've got your big, what you call the feeder papers, that's going to go down to everything that might be owned by that media group. So their star or sun paper, you know, their main paper is going to feed out to every other thing that they own in their chain. And that's going to trickle out. And then, you know, the independents, I don't really think we have that many independents left, but they grab on and they go, oh, look, because this is what a lot of times independents did. They just grab something because they don't have the staff. They can't pay for the staff to generate their unique content. for them. Now, I did one of the very first real histories that I did, I think it was number 4, was called Larry and the CIA. I think that was the title of it, but it's close enough. Larry, CIA, if you get that, you'd be able to find it. And he owned several newspapers early on in his career. And he was explaining to listeners how it works, that these small town newspapers can't generate that content. So they're dependent on the feeder companies. What I'm talking about, you know, you've got an outlet and they send out PR, they crank it out, and you buy it or you get a package.
Yeah.
Or they might give it to you. You know, if you float this story, we're going to give you 30 more stories. And you're looking for content. You're looking for filler. Yeah. And that's how it's done. So I think it's, and then you at last piece of the puzzle, just look at it. You know, sometimes fiction is truer than truth. So you've got the Newsbenders episode of television from, I believe, 1968. It was British, might have been BBC, but it's called Newsbenders. And that really tells you how it is done. You're going to generate this content or die.
Yeah. I have a clip here of the president of CBS News, who was president from 1954 to 1961. William Colby, the former CIA director, the Central Intelligence Agency owns every one of any significance in the major media. This also is a clip of a House Intelligence Committee meeting in 1975, where they're giving testimony. So I'm going to play this, and I will be sending this to you tomorrow morning when we do a wrap up. So you'll have this for yourself.
At CBS, had been contacted by the CIA. As a matter of fact, by the time I became the head of the whole news and public affairs operation in 1954, the ships had been established, and I was told about them and asked if I'd carry on with them.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to the National News Services, AP and UPI?
Well, again, I think we're getting into the kind of detail, Mr. Chairman, that I'd prefer to handle in executive session.
I think it was entirely in order for our correspondents at that time to make use of CIA agent chiefs of station and other members of the executive staff of CIA as sources of information which were useful in their assessments of world conditions.
Would you say that continues today?
Well, I would think probably for a reporter it would continue today, but because of all of the revelations of the period of the 1970s, it seems to me that a reporter's got to be much more circumspect in doing it now, or he runs the risk of at least being looked at with considerable disfavor by the public. I think you've got to be much more careful about it.
You says have the boss. Any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to a major circulation American journal?
We do have people who submit pieces to two American journals.
Do you have any people paid by the CIA who are working for television networks?
This, I think, gets into the kind of getting into the details, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to get into in executive session.
Right. So there you go.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, right there, you get it from the head of CBS. That was the president of CBS saying, you know, the reporters have to be a lot more circumspect. So there's the boss saying, well, yeah, we do it, but we've just told them you got to be more careful. You can't get busted, you know, because the public isn't going to like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I have another clip here. I don't know who this is. I want to say this was another former director or assistant director or deputy director or something back around the same time period, talking about nearly the same thing in a private interview. I believe it was on, could have been one of the networks back then, the NBC or CBS. Don't know which one it was.
CIA is not an intelligence agency. It's a covert action agency. Covert action being overthrowing or supporting foreign governments. Another part of covert action is disinformation. And the American people, in my estimation, are the primary target audience of the agency's disinformation operation. And I view Vietnam, the entire Vietnam War, was brought to us, sold to us, by agency disinformation operations. At the when I say us, I mean the American people.
There you go.
Yeah, no, Johnny, I think this is how it's long worked. And definitely, television never arrived with any kind of freedom. You know, we were sold that the internet arrived with some kind of freedom and, you know, independent user ownership or ability of free speech, which was, you know, we were sold a lie. But television never arrived with freedom. It was controlled from the outset, CIA controlled. And think of how easy that would have been then, because every country in the world, when they first got television, they might have only one or two channels. You know, the U.S. was huge with its three, ABC, yeah. NBC, CBS. That was huge. And do you remember when Fox, you know, got started? And I mean, wow.
I remember. CNN. Are you speaking specifically of news, or are you talking about just like the number of channels we had?
Well, I mean, the number of channels correlated with the news initially, you know, because you
true,
had.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I remember that the news, quote, news used to be. And this hasn't been that long ago. This has been within my lifetime. I remember when the news, and so do you, was just a 12 o'clock or a 6 o'clock or an 8 o'clock thing and an 11 o'clock thing or whatever. And that was it. So there was a morning thing that would come mm-hmm. on at like 6 to 8 or whatever it was. If you lived in a major metropolitan area such as New York or something, because rush hour in New York starts at 3:45 a.m. So you have to catch it early. So the networks up there start around usually 4:30 or something like that. But where I came from, that part of the country, it was you had the local network. You didn't have national affiliates. We didn't have anything like that. It was just the local news at a specific time. Mm-hmm. I think where it really started to go into, I mean, they pulled all the safety measures, all, you know, they removed the safety belts, if you will, and took all the airbags out of the runaway car, freight train, was when the news networks started with CNN, went to 24-hour news. And I remember that, I want to say it was one of my family members said to me 20 years ago, said 24-hour media have absolutely destroyed people's minds in this country. This is mm-hmm. before the big kickoff of social media and everything. But back then, when you had 24-hour media cycles, it destroyed the way that people were able to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's what you're looking at. Again, I'll go back to Orwell, but what it really is Big Brother talking to you all the time. You can't get away from it. It's always there, you know. I mean, at least fortunately, people who understood the dangers or were cautious with what they put into their minds could say, oh, no, I'm not taking that in, and just shut it out or not take it. We're reaching a point now where, you know, that's not to be possible. We're to get the updates no matter what. But all this is updating you in real time with what you're supposed to think about. And it's, you know, it exists in dialectic form. So you're told you've got these alternatives. Even some of the stuff we talked about in sound check was very fun to talk about and humorous. And I'd say that we probably wouldn't go there because you're name dropping in a way that and, you know, there's a kind of a mean spirited quality that comes into it. But what you're looking at in the alternative press is something that is also controlled by the CIA, was set up by the CIA as part of it. Another interesting book to look at. Sorry, I'll come back to finish that sentence in a second. But a book that's interesting to look at is The Cultural Cold War. I think it's a woman named Frances Stoner Saunders, or Saunder Stoner. I think it's Stoner Saunders. But anyway, that's a good book. And that gives you an insight into the CIA control, not just over journalism, but all of the arts and how it worked. And that has a more international, what you can see is the CIA going out internationally. But all you have to do is just apply that to home.
Well, looking at it from the aspect of kind of working in the local affiliates, kind of like we started with the newspapers, if you look at the PR talking points and things, and you know, you link up to what we were just discussing there, and you actually had it in house testimony in 1975 of the director himself saying, yeah, we got people that are involved in the networks, television news networks and things. Yeah, they get some of their stories from us. Yeah, sure. So if you're linking that up, and that's you think about that in 1975, and we fast forward to today, I want you to listen to this compilation that I have here that I've pulled up just for reference because we're on the subject, and this is really important for people to grasp. We've played this here before, but I cannot hammer this home enough. And what you're going to hear is local affiliates. These are not the national networks. These are not the big CBSs and the CNNs and all that stuff. These are the local affiliates that you have in your hometown, mm-hmm. your little region or whatever it is. And I want you to see if you can catch anything that's significant about all of them together. Listen.
Micah Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our
Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
Eastern Iowa communities.
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But
we are concerned about trouble and trying to be responsible
one-sided news stories
plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish the same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false news
has become all too common on social media.
More alarming,
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
I think they're trying to get a message across to us. I don't exactly know what it is, but I think they're all trying to tell us, you know, something. I can't quite put my finger on it. Yeah.
Johnny, that is so powerful. It's, you know, it's too bad sometimes when you just do something, you know, audio, it's too bad people can't see the visual component. Yes. But what you have there is literally dozens of local affiliates parroting the same talking point. I can't remember what it was.
Well, whatever it was, you can bet that it was extremely dangerous to our democracy. Yeah, another thing, and it's not just intelligence agencies that are involved in that kind of stuff. You also have sponsorships that carry a lot of messages too. Mm-hmm. And it's not relegated to one thing or the other. Now one particular sponsor that loves to just throw money all over the place, especially over the last 5 years, is a company called Pfizer. They love to promote whatever they need on whatever media platform you have. So whatever mainstream media outlet you have. Now, I also have a compilation of what Pfizer likes to do when it comes to your way of thinking, especially during a pandemic. Listen to this. All the different sponsors.
Is brought to you by Pfizer.
CBS Health Watch, sponsored by Pfizer.
Anderson Cooper 360.
Brought to you by Pfizer.
ABC News Nightline.
Brought to you by Pfizer.
Making a difference.
Brought to you by Pfizer.
CNN Tonight.
Brought to you by Pfizer.
Early Start.
Brought to you by Pfizer.
Friday night on Aaron Burnett Out Front.
Brought to you by Pfizer.
This Week with George Stephanopoulos is brought to you by Pfizer.
This Weather Report brought to you by Pfizer.
Today's countdown to the royal wedding is brought to you by Pfizer.
And now a CBS Sports Update brought to you by Pfizer.
Meet the Press Data Download brought to you by Pfizer.
This portion of CBS This Morning sponsored by Pfizer.
On how to find the hidden sugars in the American family diet, sponsored by Pfizer.
Gotta love that last one. You have to love that last one.
Yeah, sugar's harmful. Pfizer's good.
It is. Yeah, Pfizer's good. Yeah, they're gonna help you out with that. Listen to Vince on Thursdays. He'll tell you about sugar and what it actually does.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it's like the manipulation. That's what it all comes back to is just the manipulation and the engineering of how people think and the people that are actually behind it, pushing all these different agendas that are just, they have some serious gall to sit there and talk about calling people out for mis and disinformation when you see these other people behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, another thing that Alan often cited was a case that two reporters, I believe they were under the employ, I think they were employees of Fox. They could have been, you know, independent contractors, but I think they were employees and they had done a piece of investigative journalism and Fox would not run with it. I think they were set up to, you know, air, and Fox said, no, the affiliates aren't going to like it, et cetera, et cetera. So these journalists sued Fox. You know, they said, we've done a piece of work. And, you know, I don't remember all the particulars of the case. It's been a while since I looked at it. But the outcome was the judge ruled in favor of Fox. And the ruling said, essentially, news outlets are not required to tell you the truth or to bring you a true story. You know, they provide content, and that content is entirely up to them what they put out. But what was key to the ruling is they're not obligated to tell you truth. That's not what news is, obviously. I mean, if you look at that, you know, news is...
I can't watch it for more than a few minutes. I'm like, that's a lie. That's a lie. That's a lie. That's a lie. I can't. Like, I just can't. I can't watch. Even the tickers that roll across the bottom that nobody reads that I actually read, I'm like, that's nonsense. That's complete nonsense.
Yeah. So there's no obligation there to bring you that. This is why the whole news versus fake news, information versus disinformation or misinformation is such a, it's a joke. The purveyors of what they call real news are not giving you anything except a product that they're selling. And they place products around that, you know, their product is the, you know, the news, I'm doing air quotes. And then they do product placement around it, like Pfizer or whoever. They're selling something.
Yeah,
that's all.
Yeah, that's it. It's a media company, and it's actually interesting. You know, people. We've talked about a lot of distractions before, and how it relates to all of this stuff. The media is certainly a distraction. You know, the way that they promote their messages, that's all a distraction. If you take one of the other things that's out there that's a big distraction, I criticize all the time. It's football, right? People love their football. Man, they love to watch football. You know, it's the modern day, in my opinion, modern day gladiatorial arena kind of thing. You know, that's the Coliseum. That's your bread and circuses kind of thing. That's what's going on. While we're losing our countries, people are in the Coliseum cheering. In my opinion, that's what I equate it to, just looking at it. Because if you were to take even a tenth of that energy that people have on Sundays to go to a NASCAR event or a football game or whatever, and you put that towards positive change, not just in your community, but in your state or wherever, you'd be surprised the difference that can be made. But people just don't do that.
Absolutely.
They just don't do it. But if you look at the NFL, just that, not talking about all the other sports companies, you know, the NBA or whatever. If you look at just the NFL, it's a media company first. And it's a sports company second. A lot of these big sports outlets are that way. They're media PR companies. And then they just kind of, they sell the product. They sell the sport. So it's just like you're talking about with the television news. They have the product around it. The players, their performance is what they're selling you. But it's all pushed as a PR campaign as to how that's done. And it's that way. And you've got, except with this one, it's a spectator sport. So you've got like all the big investors up there in the luxury sky boxes or whatever, you know. But it's really that way. And people, they don't even stop to think about the fact that they're supporting media companies first. And the sports they're actually interested in are just a close second. They don't even actually matter.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm sure if you ever did a compilation of the sports announcers, you know, except for the given, you know, the score on any given day, it's the same thing. The way in which they deliver it is so scripted, you know.
Yeah. All the announcers. I used to be a big baseball fan. I played baseball for 14 years. So, I mean, you play it that long, it's kind of a, you know, becomes a part of you. And I played it for many years. I started when I was seven and I went all the way up into high school and going into college years. And I was a big fan of the game until it became about politics and everything else. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, just like anything else, that's what it is. I used to, before all of, you know, the world went to hell and everything, I used to watch the baseball games. I used to get the baseball package because I was a, you know, big baseball fan. So I wanted to watch some games from back in the U.S. I wanted to watch some of the New York Yankees games. I was a big Yankee fan. I wanted to watch some of the Cincinnati Reds games and things like that because I was a fan as a kid. And it is that way when you go through and you watch all the different games, all the announcers are the mm-hmm. same. All of them are the same. They have their own little quirky, you know, whatever, their own little shtick or whatever you want to call it, their own little spiel. But everybody has their own little spin on it. But they all announce the same way. It's all the same.
And, you know, my brother, I live with my younger brother and he loves sports. He loves the sports. And so I pass through. I see the pastor. But what I get with the sports announcers, there seem to be four types. You've got the elder statesman sportscaster.
Yep,
and
yep. The seasoned guy that knows everything. Yeah.
Exactly.
He's been in the game for six decades. Yeah, he's there.
Yeah. And then you've got the, I call him flamboyant, and he's usually going to be between the age of, say, 35 and 50, and he might be a retired athlete. He usually is, but there's something flamboyant about him. So it might be an extravagant beard or a really colorful blazer. He's Mr. Flamboyant. Then you've got the African-American, and the African-American is also usually a retired athlete. And for whatever reason, he's typically the more eloquent or
very well spoken.
And then you've got the fourth, which is to me the worst of all. I call it fingernails on the chalkboard. And that's the female.
And yes, they have, and she's the on-field correspondent usually.
Yes,
yeah, and she's down there on the sideline giving the report. Yes. We're going to go down to so and so on the sidelines to give us a full report.
Oh, Johnny, if she even sounded like you, that would be okay. I could tolerate it. But they all the females go to the same school where they all sound the same. It's strident, harsh. I can't do it. But it's just such a. How did you feel about that?
Yeah.
You were out there and at the last moment you caught that. And
Yeah. And they're screaming because the crowd behind them is screaming or whatever, you know, because there was a play that just went on or something.
Yeah.
It is interesting the way that you're describing that. I find that, and we're kind of equating this back to the politics or to the business world. So let's look at the way that the people behave on the stage, for example, down in Davos at the World Economic Forum. They all sound the same, you know, like all the business leaders or whatever, the politicians or whatever, when they're up there on the stage and they're giving one of their little panel discussions about something, doesn't matter what it is or even who it is, they're all speaking with the same cadence. It's all the same tempo between all of them. Why? Mm-hmm. Because of the same reason, the same people that are on the television network on that sports game or that, you know, that announcer for that event or whatever, and that person that's over there on that media network, they've all gone to their own same institutions to get that cadence and those talking points and the way to behave.
Yeah.
So it's a manufactured process through all of that.
Yeah. You see you're so dead on with that. It's the Aspen Institute or the Davos. They're like a slightly muted TED talker, you know. It's just, you know, let's unpack this, okay?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Let's do that. Let's sit down like Alexander Soros and just talk about ums and you know ands and ahs and you know whatever. Yeah.
Poor Alexander.
Yeah, I think he's got himself a new girlfriend now. So yeah,
I saw that.
She's going to straighten him out. You better believe it. So I think after that showing that he gave, which there was no cadence about that at all. After that showing that he gave on the stage at Davos, I think they're going to grab him with the hook and pull him off stage for a little bit because you haven't seen or heard much from him other than the fact he came out and said a tweet about Trump or something. I don't know, after some verdict.
Well, there's a difference between the bureaucrat and a billionaire son. You know, the bureaucrats have had years and years and years of the right kind of training, the right institutions. They know how to talk.
Yes. They're going to give him some training.
Yeah.
Is my point.
Bureaucrats are adept at saying things like, let's take the granular view here, you know, and then they give you the granular view ad nauseum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're going to tell you. Right. We're going to go ahead and wrap up here. Would you like to tell people what you've got going on the website and about your latest podcast?
Yes. My latest podcast is going to come out tomorrow. And I really enjoyed that. And it was with a licensed counselor by the name of John Euler, J-O-N, last name U-H-L-E-R. And it was actually Neil Foster who brought him to my attention more than a year ago, and because of his website called unmaskingthetransmovement.com.
I'm looking forward to that podcast.
Yeah, and this is actually going to be part one of two episodes that we're doing just on psychopathy. We're going to get into a little bit of sexual psychopathy, and then we're going to do two more talks after these two in through September, I think. So that's an interesting one. He's got a wealth of knowledge. He's worked with sex offenders. He's worked with a lot of survivors, and I just think we can't know enough about psychopaths because that's who we're run by.
Very clearly is what we've discussed here tonight. Yes, we are run by psychopaths.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Your website, anything you got going on the website you'd like to tell people about?
I mentioned it on the Redux. I just hadn't, the last couple of weeks, I hadn't been able to keep up with things there. So I'm hoping that as I feel better, I'll be putting up a new author's excerpt. I've got another Signs and Symbols we've done, the All-Seeing Eye and Serpent, very, really interesting short excerpts there. And then the weekly Redux on every Sunday. So there's always a lot going on. Unfortunately, I just haven't had the energy and steam to keep up with it. So I have things, what do they call it, in the pipeline or things ready to go that I just haven't had the energy to get up. So don't give up on me. There'll be more coming on the website in the next week.
Very good. Well, I hope you make full recovery. You're on the road to it now. So I think by the next time you are on in 2 weeks, you should be back to normal. Yes.
Yes. I can hold my head up.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been an absolutely fantastic conversation, Melissa. I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you for being here today. Thank you to all the listeners. God bless everyone. And have a great evening.